All right, welcome back to the deep dive.
It's great to be back.
So you know how much I love to learn new things, and
You do.
I do.
You really do.
I get excited about it.
Yes, you do.
I really love to go deep on things, and we've got another really cool opportunity for a deep dive today
We do.
into Puritanism.
Yes.
I am really excited about this one. This is something that I've always wanted to learn more about, and really getting into those origins in England, and then of
Absolutely.
course that transatlantic voyage and really how it developed over here
It's a whole story,
and the
yeah.
legacy that we see today.
Yeah, because it has a huge one.
Oh, absolutely huge. Yeah.
It's profound.
It's really amazing to me that something that happened so long ago still has such a profound impact on us today.
For sure.
And so I'm excited to unpack this, and you've shared with us a fantastic resource, which is excerpts from this university lecture series
Right.
that goes all the way from the Reformation to the present day.
To the present day.
So we're talking centuries of history here.
Centuries.
I love this because it's kind of like, getting access to this college
Right.
course without having to pay tuition.
No tests.
And no tests, right?
Just the learning.
Just all the fun stuff.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
And so I'm excited to kind of get your take on this too, because this is something that you've spent a lot of time thinking about and studying.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's really helpful to look at it through the lens of this lecture series because it provides such a nice broad sweep of history,
Yeah.
and gives us a really good foundation, I think, to understand the nuances of the Puritan story.
So our mission today is to kind of extract that essence of Puritan theology
Right.
and really trace, that expansion to America,
Right.
and that birth of Congregationalism that we see here in America.
We see it in England as well. I
Yeah.
mean, that's where it starts.
Right, of course, yeah.
But yeah, it really takes root in America in a very unique way.
And then to explore the rise of the Baptist movement as well. I mean,
Yeah.
these are all things that are so interconnected.
They are.
I'm curious to see how all these pieces fit
Me
together.
too.
And also to look at, what led to that shift in Puritan influence.
Right.
Because it's not like it's this monolithic thing that's, unchanging over time. So
Yeah.
those are all the things we're going to be exploring, and we're, as always, we're digging for those essential insights.
Of course.
But also those like little details
Yeah.
that,
The gems.
the gems, yeah, the things that make history like come alive.
The things that make you go, "Oh, wow, I didn't know that."
Exactly.
Yeah.
So let's unpack this.
Okay, let's do it.
Now, before we dive into like the Puritans themselves,
Right.
I think it's really important to understand the religious landscape of England
Absolutely.
at the time, where this whole movement took root. And as our source material reminds us, that initial spark of the Reformation was really happening on the continent,
Yeah.
Germany with Luther and then Switzerland with Calvin.
Right. Yeah.
But then things started to shift a little bit, and England really emerged as this like major center
Yeah, it did.
for Reformation thought and activity.
It did.
So that evolving English context is super important for understanding where Puritanism comes from and the issues that they were grappling with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting is that England had always had a bit of a unique relationship with the Catholic Church.
Right.
Even going back to Henry VIII and the whole break from Rome.
Right, yeah.
So there was already this kind of sense of independence there.
Yeah.
And a willingness to kind of chart their own course.
Yeah.
So when the Reformation comes along, it's not surprising that England is going to have its own unique take on it.
Right.
And the Puritans are a big part of that.
So as the Reformation gained traction in England, we see this particular group, the Puritans,
Right.
who really felt like the Church of England hadn't gone far enough.
Hadn't fully embraced, the reformed principles,
Right. Yeah.
to their satisfaction.
Right,
They
right.
felt like there's still a lot of work to do.
Exactly. And when we consider their theology, the lecture points to this really interesting kind of change in emphasis.
Yeah.
The early Reformation was very focused on the doctrine of justification by faith
Right.
and assurance of salvation,
Yeah.
how individuals find their way to God.
Right. What must I do to be saved?
Yeah,
Valid
exactly.
question.
But for the Puritans, it seems like that main theological focus shifted towards ecclesiology,
Exactly.
which is essentially the study of the church.
Yeah, the structure, the governance, the practices, all
Okay.
of that.
So it's like moving from that very personal individual experience to like
the more corporate.
Yeah. How do we do this together?
Right. How do we live this out as a community?
Right.
And how do we organize ourselves as the people of God?
And how do we actually structure this thing called the church?
Right. Right.
And the lecture highlights two major areas of concern for them.
Yeah.
Liturgy and polity.
Polity. Big words.
Yeah.
Big words, but important concepts.
So let's break those down a little bit.
Okay.
So liturgy, as you might expect, has to do with, you know, how church services are conducted.
Right, right.
And the Puritans felt like the Anglican Church was still holding on to too many traditions and rituals from its Catholic past.
Yeah. There was a lot of carryover there, and they weren't happy about it.
Yeah.
They really wanted to strip things down.
Yeah.
And get back to what they saw is the pure essence of worship.
Right. And they wanted a simpler form of worship, one that they felt was more directly aligned with Scripture.
With Scripture, yes.
And Reformed theology.
Yes. And they were very much, you know, students of the Bible.
Yeah.
And they really believed that everything had to be grounded in Scripture.
And so they would look at certain practices in the Anglican Church and say, well,
where is that in the Bible?
Yeah. Show me the verse.
Yeah.
That supports this.
Yeah, and if it wasn't there, they weren't interested.
Right, right.
They wanted to get rid of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were really looking for a pure form of worship.
Hence the name.
Hence the name Puritans.
Yeah. And then the other big concern was polity.
Polity.
Which has to do with how the church is governed.
Yes, how decisions are made, who's in charge.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
And they were not fans of the hierarchical structure.
No, they were not.
Of the Anglican Church.
Right.
With its bishops and archbishops.
All the pomp and circumstance.
Yeah. You know, this whole top-down.
Top-down authority.
Yeah.
Yes.
And instead, they advocated for a system where the local congregation had a lot more say.
Yeah. Much more congregational rule. Where the people have a say in how the church is run.
That's a key phrase there.
It is.
The people have a say.
It is. And, you know, that's a very democratic idea.
Right.
And it's something that's going to have a profound impact on the development of America.
We'll get to that. But that's fascinating to think about, that connection between that idea of congregational rule and the development of democracy in America.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so this desire for more local church control is directly linked to this emergence of the English independent movement,
sure.
which were these groups who just decided that, you know, reforming the Church of England from within wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, they'd given up on that.
Yeah.
They were like, you know what? We're just going to start our own churches.
Right.
And do our own thing.
Yeah. So they're like, all right, let's separate. Let's just go our own way.
Right, right.
And it's within this broader landscape of these independent churches that we see, you know, groups like the Pilgrims emerging.
The Pilgrims, yeah.
Ah, the Pilgrims.
That's somebody who loves the Pilgrims.
Right. And their story is such a familiar part of early American history.
It is.
And as the lecture reminds us, they were part of this independent movement.
Yes.
And they eventually journeyed to America.
Yes, they did.
But here's where it gets really interesting, is that this subsequent wave of Puritan immigrants who arrived a little bit later in the Massachusetts Bay Area around, you know, what's now Boston.
Boston, yeah.
They had a slightly different viewpoint.
Yeah, they weren't quite as radical as the Pilgrims.
Right.
You know, the Pilgrims were separatists. They had completely broken away from the Church of England.
Right.
The Puritans at this point were still hoping to reform it from within.
Right. They were still holding on to that.
They weren't quite ready to give up on that yet.
Right. So you have these two groups who are kind of coming at it from
slightly different angles.
Yeah. Slightly different perspectives.
Yeah.
And the lecture highlights this, that the Puritans weren't actually all that thrilled.
No, they weren't.
With the Plymouth colony. Like, they were not happy with those Pilgrims.
They were like, what are you guys doing over there?
Right.
You know, you're making us look bad.
Right, right. Because they're like, you're separatists.
Yeah.
And we're not separatists.
Right. We're still trying to work within the system.
Right. And they hadn't given up on that hope of purifying.
Purifying, yes.
The Church of England.
Yeah.
So you have these two distinct groups in early America.
Right.
With these related but kind of different visions for church and society.
Yeah.
The Pilgrims were already practicing a form of congregationalism.
They were.
Where each local church was largely self-governing.
Yes, very decentralized.
And as the Puritans in Massachusetts found their ties to the Anglican Church kind of weakening, they also increasingly adopted that congregational polity.
Yeah, it was a very practical thing. you know, they were so far away from England.
Yeah.
That the hierarchical structure of the Anglican Church just wasn't really feasible.
Right.
So they kind of had to adapt, and Congregationalism was a natural fit.
And this brings us to a very pivotal moment in 1648.
Okay.
Which is the Cambridge Platform.
It's a Cambridge Platform.
And the lecture describes this as the joining together of the Puritans and the Independents.
Right.
Which were the Pilgrims.
The Pilgrims, yeah.
To really establish Congregationalism as a distinct denomination in America.
Right. So this is a really big deal.
Yeah.
Because it's the moment where these two groups who had been kind of separate,
right,
come together and say, okay, we're going to unite under this banner of Congregationalism.
Right, right. And they're finding that common ground in this belief,
yeah,
in how churches should be organized and governed.
Exactly.
And what's fascinating to me is that by 1648,
yeah,
the Puritans in America had really shifted their focus away,
right,
from reforming the Anglican Church.
Yeah, yeah. They'd given up on that.
They'd given up. Yeah, they're like, all right.
Or we're over here now.
We're over here. Let's build our own thing.
We're going to build our own thing, yeah.
And so the Cambridge Platform really formalizes that new reality,
right,
and provides this foundational document for American Congregationalism.
Right. It's the Constitution of American Congregationalism.
Yeah. And the lecture even refers to it as the Charter.
The Charter.
Of American Congregationalism.
Yeah.
So it's like solidifying this particular form of church governance,
right,
as like the prevalent model in the region.
The dominant model, yeah.
By 1648.
Yeah.
So if your heritage is in Congregationalism.
This is your origin story.
Yeah. This is where it all began.
Right here in America.
And it really underscores how central ecclesiology,
yes,
these questions of church structure and governance,
right,
had become for these religious movements.
Yeah, absolutely. This was the burning issue for them. And it's from this very focus on ecclesiology that we see another significant independent movement emerging, the Baptists.
Okay, let's talk about the Baptists.
The Baptists.
The lecturer introduces us to two key figures.
Yeah.
In their early history.
John Smith. And Thomas Helwys.
And Thomas Helwys.
Yeah.
And they were associates.
They were.
Both initially part of this independent movement.
Right.
Who decided to separate from the Anglican Church around 1608.
Yeah, they were like, we're out of here.
Yeah.
This isn't for us.
And they had a very specific theological conviction.
They did.
That set them apart from many other groups.
Yeah, this is a big one.
And that was their core belief about baptism.
Baptism, yeah.
They rejected the widespread practice of infant baptism.
Right.
Which was common among Catholics, Anglicans.
Even other independent groups. Yeah. You know, it's just kind of the assumed thing to do.
Right.
But Smith and Helwys were like, no.
Yeah.
We don't see that in the Bible. Right. We think baptism should only be for adults.
Adults who've made a conscious profession of faith.
A conscious profession of faith, yeah.
So they're really emphasizing that personal decision.
Yeah, that personal ownership of your faith.
Yeah.
That you're not just being born into it.
Right.
You're choosing it.
Right, right.
And that's a big deal.
And this conviction actually led them to seek refuge in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Specifically Amsterdam.
Amsterdam, yeah.
Which was known for its relative religious tolerance.
Right. They were a little bit more open-minded over there.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't quite as strict as England was.
Right, right, right.
So it was a place where people could go and practice their faith.
Yeah. Without fear of persecution.
Without fear of persecution.
Yeah. And now here's a surprising detail.
Okay.
That the lecture highlights is that John Smith was so committed to this principle of adult baptism,
yes,
that he actually baptized himself.
He did.
In one of the canals in Amsterdam.
He did what?
Yeah, he like jumps in the canal.
That's pretty hardcore.
And baptizes himself.
Yeah, that's a statement right there.
Yeah.
You know, he's not messing around.
Yeah, he's like, this is how serious I am about this.
Yeah, this is what I believe.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm willing to go to these lengths to show it.
Yeah. And I think what's so fascinating about that is it's not just the act itself.
Right.
It's the symbolism of it.
It's the symbolism.
Yes. You know, he's making this very public declaration.
Yeah, he's not doing this in secret.
Of his beliefs.
He's out there for everyone to see.
Yeah, and it's this clear departure from established religious traditions.
He's breaking with the past.
Right.
He's saying, this is a new way.
Yeah.
This is a new way of doing things.
And so the lecture tells us that Smith and Hellis
yeah.
are really seen as these early figures.
They're pioneers.
Who set the stage for the Baptist movement.
The godfathers of the Baptist movement.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And following Smith's death in 1612, Hellis actually returns to London.
He does.
And establishes what is widely considered to be the first Baptist congregation there.
Wow, so right back to the lion's den.
Back into the lion's den.
Yeah, he's not afraid.
Yeah, he's bold.
He's bold, yeah.
And now the lecture goes on to distinguish between two early streams
right.
within the Baptist movement.
Yeah.
And these are the General Baptists.
The General Baptists.
And Calvinist Baptists.
And the Calvinist Baptists, yeah.
So there's already this division even within...
Right. From the very beginning, there's this tension.
Yeah.
Between these two different theological viewpoints.
So the first group, which included Smith and Hellis,
yeah.
became known as the General Baptists or the Arminian Baptists.
Or the Arminian Baptists, yeah.
And their theology emphasized free will.
Free will, yes.
The belief that individuals have the capacity to choose.
Right.
To accept or reject God's grace.
Yeah, that God gives everyone this ability to choose.
Yeah.
And that's a very controversial idea.
Right.
Especially in the context of Calvinism.
Right, because Calvinism is really emphasizing predestination.
Predestination, yeah.
God's sovereignty.
Yeah, God is, or is he chosen? Who will be saved?
Right.
And who will not be saved?
And they were labeled Arminian.
Yeah.
Because their views aligned with the teachings of Jacob Arminius.
Jacob Arminius, yes.
A Dutch theologian.
A Dutch theologian.
Who advocated for free will in the process of salvation.
Right. He was kind of like the anti-Calvin.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
And then around 1638, another group emerged in London.
Okay.
Called the Calvinist Baptists.
The Calvinist Baptists.
Sometimes referred to as Particular Baptists.
Particular Baptists, yeah.
And they held a very different theological emphasis.
They did.
Strongly adhering to those Calvinistic doctrines.
Yeah, particularly the concept of double predestination.
Yeah.
Which is that God has not only chosen who will be saved.
Right.
But he's also chosen who will be damned.
So they're taking it a step further.
Yeah, a little bit more intense.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah. Well.
If you're not elect,
yeah.
then tough luck.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they really differed from the General Baptists in their understanding of free will.
Right, right.
They didn't see a lot of room for human choice in the matter.
So even within this movement,
yeah.
that's united by this specific practice, like
right.
adult baptism.
Yeah.
We see these significant theological differences emerging.
Yeah, they can't even agree on that.
Right.
You know, they're both Baptists.
Yeah.
But they have very different understandings of what that means.
Yeah, and it's fascinating how these movements are never...
Monolithic.
Yeah, they're never this, like, unified,
yeah.
homogenous...
There's always diversity.
Yes.
There's always debate.
Yeah, and that's part of what makes it so interesting to study.
It is.
And the lecture then discusses this formation of associations...
Right.
...among these early Baptists,
yeah.
both General and Calvinists.
Yeah, they're trying to find some common ground.
Right.
Even though they disagree on some pretty fundamental things.
Right. And this is key to understanding how Baptist identity and practices developed,
yeah.
given their emphasis on the autonomy of the local church.
Right. So for Baptists, the ultimate authority resides in the local congregation.
Right.
So these associations weren't about imposing rules
right.
or creating a hierarchy.
Right. It wasn't like a top-down...
No, it was much more of a grassroots thing.
Yeah.
It was a way for churches to connect with each other.
Right.
To articulate their shared beliefs.
Yeah.
And offer mutual support.
Yeah.
You know, they were kind of like a network
yeah.
of independent churches.
Right, right. So they're coming together.
Yeah.
To share ideas and support each other.
To learn from each other.
And not necessarily.
To tell each other what to do.
Right.
Right.
They're still maintaining that autonomy.
That autonomy is very important to them.
And what's fascinating is to see what kinds of issues these Baptist associations addressed.
Right.
And the lecture lists several key points.
Okay.
All reflecting their core convictions about church life.
Okay.
And these included things like the gathering of churches.
Right.
Which is this idea that church membership is based on a voluntary conversion experience.
Yeah. You have to choose to be a part of the church.
Right. It's not just something you're born into.
Right. It's not a birthright.
Right.
You have to make a conscious decision.
And then, of course, the practice of believer's baptism.
Only adults.
Only adults, yeah.
No babies.
And their stance on relationships with those outside the church, which often led to separatist tendencies.
Yeah, they were a little bit wary of the world.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to keep themselves pure.
Right.
And so they tended to separate themselves from those who didn't share their beliefs.
And then the belief that the authority for ordination resided within the local church.
Right. So no bishops.
No bishops.
No outside authorities.
The church gets to decide.
The church gets to decide.
And they also grappled with their relationship with the government, generally advocating for a separation of church and state.
Yes.
But as the lecture points out, their primary motivation for this was to protect their own religious freedom from government interference.
Yeah, they didn't want the government meddling in their affairs.
Right.
They had seen what happened in England.
Right.
Where the church was very much controlled by the state.
And they didn't want that to happen here. And that's an important distinction from some of the modern arguments for church-state separation that emphasize a more secular basis for government.
Right, right.
So they weren't necessarily trying to create a secular state in the way that we think about it today.
No, they were just trying to protect their own freedom.
Right, right. It was more about protecting themselves than it was about creating a
secular society.
In a secular society.
Yeah.
So the associations also discussed missionary work.
Right.
The nature of church worship.
Yeah.
Which was typically simpler than Anglican services.
Much simpler.
And sometimes included practices like foot washing.
Foot washing.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
It is an interesting practice.
Church discipline.
Yeah.
And even how Baptist principles should be applied within family life.
Right. So they were really trying to live out their faith in every aspect of their lives.
Yeah. It's a very holistic approach.
Yeah. It's not just about Sunday morning.
Right.
It's about everything.
Yeah. It permeates every aspect of life.
Exactly.
But as the lecture notes, this unity within the Baptist movement
wasn't
always sustained.
No.
Divisions arose.
Of course they did.
Yeah. And that's always the case.
Right. Yeah. Whenever you have people,
you're going to have disagreements.
You're going to have disagreements. And the lecture details how many of the general Baptist congregations over time evolved into Unitarianism.
Unitarianism.
Yes. Which is a theological perspective that questions the divinity of Christ.
Right. And the doctrine of the Trinity.
And the doctrine of the Trinity, yeah.
So they're moving away from some pretty core Christian beliefs.
Right, right. And so this is a major shift.
Yeah, it is.
And on the other hand, some of the Calvinist Baptists reacting against what they perceived as theological liberalism drifted towards hyper-Calvinism.
Hyper-Calvinism.
Which is a view that sometimes rejected the necessity of missionary work based on a very strict interpretation of predestination.
Yeah. If God's already chosen who will be saved, then why bother trying to convert people?
Right. What's the point?
Yeah.
Right. So it's like a very
fatalistic.
Yeah. Fatalistic approach.
Yeah.
And so we see how even within these movements that are grounded in a specific set of beliefs, you can have these significant internal shifts and disagreements over time.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that's important to remember about any religious movement.
Right.
They're not static.
They're constantly evolving.
They're constantly evolving,
And the lecture concludes this section by highlighting this wide array of Baptist denominations that exist today.
Oh, yeah. There's a ton of them.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And it's all a direct result of these early divisions.
Right.
And subsequent theological developments.
Yeah. So from these independent roots centered on ecclesiology, we see these two major branches of Protestantism taking shape.
Congregationalism and Baptist. Two very important movements in American religious history.
But the story doesn't end there.
No, it doesn't.
Because not everyone in America embraced that Puritan vision.
Right.
And so the lecture now turns to these reactions to the Puritans in America and emphasizing that their dominance was not universally accepted.
Right. They had their critics.
They had their critics, yeah.
And these challenges, I think, are really important because they contribute significantly to the increasing religious diversity in the colonies.
So this is where we start to see America becoming this melting pot.
A melting pot of religion.
Of religions,
And
the first major reaction we encounter is Roger Williams.
Roger Williams.
And Roger Williams is a fascinating figure.
He is.
The lecturer calls him one of the most important men.
Yeah.
In the 17th
century. The 17th century, yeah.
In American religious history.
Yeah, he's a big deal.
He's a big deal.
Yeah.
And he starts out as an Anglican in England.
Okay.
Then he becomes a Puritan in Boston.
Right.
But ultimately, he moves towards a separatist viewpoint.
So he's kind of going through this theological journey.
He's on a journey, yeah.
Yeah.
And his central conviction is this principle of absolute religious freedom and liberty.
Yeah, this is his big thing.
This is his thing, yeah.
Childish freedom.
Which goes beyond mere toleration.
Yeah.